Men inducted into the army from Haskell County trained at Funston. There was a small but constant flow of traffic between the two places. On March 4th, a private at Funston, a cook, reported ill with influenza at sick call. Within 3 weeks, more than 1,100 soldiers were sick enough to be admitted to the hospital, and thousands more, the precise number was not recorded, needed treatment at infirmaries scattered around the base. Pneumonia developed in 237 men, roughly 20% of those hospitalized, but only 38 men died. While that was a higher death toll than one would normally expect from influenza, it was not so high as to draw attention, much less than the death rate in Haskell, and only a tiny fraction of the death rate to come. All influenza viruses mutate constantly. The timing of the Funston explosion strongly suggests that the influenza outbreak there came from Haskell. If Haskell was the source, whoever carried it to Funston brought a mild version of the virus, but it was a version capable of mutating back to lethality. Meanwhile, Funston fed a constant stream of men to other American bases and to Europe, men whose business was killing. They would be more proficient at it than they could imagine. Chapter 7. No one will ever know with absolute certainty whether the 1918-19 influenza pandemic actually did originate in Haskell County, Kansas. There are other theories of origin. But Frank McFarlane Burnett, a Nobel laureate who lived through the pandemic and spent most of his scientific career studying influenza, later concluded that the evidence was strongly suggestive that the 1918 influenza pandemic began in the United States, and that its spread was intimately related to war conditions and especially the arrival of American troops in France. Numerous other scientists agree with him. And the evidence does strongly suggest that Camp Funston experienced the first major outbreak of influenza in America. If so, the movement of men from an influenza-infested Haskell to Funston also strongly suggests Haskell as the site of origin. Regardless of where it began, to understand what happened next, one must first understand viruses and the concept of the mutant swarm. Viruses are themselves an enigma that exist on the edges of life. They are not simply small bacteria. Bacteria consist of only one cell, but they are fully alive. Each has a metabolism, requires food, produces waste, and reproduces by division. Viruses do not eat or burn oxygen for energy. They do not engage in any process that could be considered metabolic. They do not produce waste. They do not have sex. They make no side products by accident or design. They do not even reproduce independently. They are less than a fully living organism, but more than an inert collection of chemicals. Several theories of their origin exist, and these theories are not mutually exclusive. Evidence exists to support all of them, and different viruses may have developed in different ways. A minority view suggests that viruses originated independently as the most primitive molecules capable of replicating themselves. If this is so, more advanced life forms could have evolved from them. More virologists think the opposite, that viruses began as more complex living cells and evolved, or more accurately, devolved, into simpler organisms. This theory does seem to fit some organisms, such as the Rickettsia family of pathogens. Rickettsia used to be considered viruses, but are now thought of as halfway between bacteria and viruses. Researchers believe they once possessed, but lost, activities necessary for independent life. The leprosy bacillus also seems to have moved from complexity, doing many things, toward simplicity, doing fewer. A third theory argues that viruses were once part of a cell, an organelle, but broke away and began to evolve independently. Whatever the origin, a virus has only one function, to replicate itself. But unlike other life forms, If a virus is considered a life form, a virus does not even do that itself. It invades cells that have energy, and then, like some alien puppet master, it subverts them, takes them over, forces them to make thousands, and in some cases, hundreds of thousands of new viruses. The power to do this lies in their genes. In most life forms, genes are stretched out along the length of a filament-like molecule of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. But many viruses, including influenza, HIV, and the coronavirus that causes SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, encode their genes in RNA, ribonucleic acid, an even simpler but less stable molecule. Genes resemble software. Just as a sequence of bits in a computer code tells the computer what to do, whether to run a word processing program, a computer game, or an internet search, genes tell the cell what to do. Computer code is a binary language. It has only two letters. The genetic code uses a language of four letters, each representing the chemicals adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. In some cases, uracil substitutes for thymine. DNA and RNA are strings of these chemicals. In effect, they are very long sequences of letters. Sometimes these letters do not form words or sentences that make any known sense. In fact, 97% of human DNA does not contain genes and is referred to as nonsense or junk DNA. But when the letters spell out words and sentences that do make sense, then that sequence is, by definition, a gene. When a gene in a cell is activated, it orders the cell to make particular proteins. Proteins can be used like bricks as building blocks of tissue. The proteins that one eats generally do end up building tissue. But proteins also play crucial roles in most chemical reactions within the body, as well as in carrying messages to start and stop different processes. Insulin, for example, is a hormone but also a protein. It helps regulate the metabolism, and it particularly affects blood glucose levels. When a virus successfully invades a cell, it inserts its own genes into the cell's genome, and the viral genes seize control from the cell's own genes. The cell's internal machinery then begins producing what the viral genes demand instead of what the cell needs for itself. So the cell turns out hundreds of thousands of viral proteins, which bind together with copies of the viral genome to form new viruses. Then the new viruses escape. In this process, the host cell almost always dies, usually when the new viral particles burst through the cell surface to invade other cells. But if viruses perform only one task, they are not simple, nor are they primitive. Highly evolved, elegant in their focus, more efficient at what they do than any fully living being, they have become nearly perfect infectious organisms. And the influenza virus is among the most perfect of these perfect organisms. Louis Sullivan, the first great modern architect, declared that form follows function. To understand viruses, or for that matter to understand biology, one must think as Sullivan did, in a language not of words, which simply name things, but in a language of three dimensions, a language of shape and form. For in biology, especially at the cellular and molecular levels, nearly all activity depends ultimately upon form, upon physical structure, upon what is called stereochemistry. The language is written in an alphabet of pyramids, cones, spikes, mushrooms, blocks, hydras, umbrellas, spheres, ribbons twisted into every imaginable Escher-like fold, and in fact, every shape imaginable. Each form is defined in exquisite and absolutely precise detail, and each carries a message. Basically, everything in the body, whether it belongs there or not, either carries a form on its surface, a marking, a piece that identifies it as a unique entity, or its entire form and being comprises that message. In this last case, it is pure information, pure message, and it embodies perfectly Marshall McLuhan's observation that the medium is the message. Reading the message, like reading Braille, is an intimate act, an act of contact and sensitivity. Everything in the body communicates in this way, sending and receiving messages by contact. This communication occurs in much the same way that a round peg fits into a round hole. When they fit together, when they match each other in size, the peg binds to the hole. Although the various shapes in the body are usually more complex than a round peg, the concept is the same. Within the body, cells, proteins, viruses, and everything else constantly bump against one another and make physical contact. When one protuberance fits the other not at all, each moves on. Nothing happens. But when one complements the other, the act becomes increasingly intimate. If they fit together well enough, they bind. Sometimes they fit as loosely as the round peg in the round hole, in which case they may separate. Sometimes they fit more snugly, like a skeleton key in a simple lock on a closet door. Sometimes they fit with exquisite precision, like a variegated key in a far more secure lock. Then events unfold. Things change. The body reacts. The results of this binding can be as dramatic or destructive as any act of sex or love or hate or violence. There are three different types of influenza viruses, A, B, and C. Type C rarely causes disease in humans. Type B does cause disease, but not epidemics. Only influenza A viruses cause epidemics or pandemics. An epidemic being a local or national outbreak, a pandemic a worldwide one. Influenza viruses did not originate in humans. Their natural home is in wild aquatic birds, and many more variants of influenza viruses exist in birds than in humans. But the disease is considerably different in birds and humans. In birds, the virus infects the gastrointestinal tract. Bird droppings contain large amounts of virus, and infectious virus can contaminate cold lakes and other water supplies. Massive exposure to an avian virus can infect man directly, but an avian virus cannot go from person to person. It cannot, that is, unless it first changes, unless it first adapts to humans. This happens rarely, but it does happen. The virus may also go through an intermediary mammal, especially swine, and jump from swine to man. Whenever a new variant of the influenza virus does adapt to humans, it will threaten to spread rapidly across the world. It will threaten a pandemic. Pandemics often come in waves, and the cumulative morbidity rate, the number of people who get sick in all the waves combined, often exceeds 50%. One virologist considers influenza so infectious that he calls it a special instance among infectious diseases, transmitted so effectively that it exhausts the supply of susceptible hosts. Influenza and other viruses, not bacteria, combine to cause approximately 90% of all respiratory infections, including sore throats. Nonetheless, people today often demand antibiotics from physicians, and the physicians too often accommodate them. But antibiotics have no effect whatsoever on viruses. Administering them serves only to increase resistance to antibiotics by bacteria. Bacteria that survive exposure to antibiotics become immune to them. Coronaviruses, the cause of the common cold as well as SARS, parainfluenza viruses, and many other viruses all cause symptoms akin to influenza, and all are often confused with it. As a result, sometimes people designate mild respiratory infections as flu and dismiss them. But influenza is not simply a bad cold. It is a quite specific disease, with a distinct set of symptoms and epidemiological behavior. In humans, the virus directly attacks only the respiratory system, and it becomes increasingly dangerous as it penetrates deeper into the lungs. Indirectly, it affects many parts of the body, and even a mild infection can cause pain in muscles and joints, intense headache, and prostration. It may also lead to far more grave complications. The overwhelming majority of influenza victims usually recover fully within 10 days. Partly because of this, and partly because the disease is confused with the common cold, influenza is rarely viewed with concern. Yet even when outbreaks are not deadly as a whole, influenza strikes so many people that even the mildest viruses almost always kill. Currently in the United States, even without an epidemic or pandemic, the Centers for Disease Control estimates that influenza kills, on average, 36,000 people a year. It is, however, not only an endemic disease, a disease that is always around. It also arrives in epidemic and pandemic form. And pandemics can be more lethal, sometimes much, much more lethal than epidemic disease. Throughout known history, there have been periodic pandemics of influenza, usually several a century. They erupt when a new influenza virus emerges. And the nature of the influenza virus makes it inevitable that new viruses emerge. The virus itself is nothing more than a membrane, a sort of envelope that contains the genome, the 8 genes that define what the virus is. It is usually spherical. It can take other shapes, about 1/10,000th of a millimeter in diameter, and it looks something like a dandelion with a forest of 2 differently shaped protuberances, one roughly like a spike, the other roughly like a tree, jutting out from its surface. These protuberances provide the virus with its actual mechanism of attack. That attack, and the defensive war the body wages, is typical of how shape and form determine outcomes. The protuberances akin to spikes are hemagglutinin. When the virus collides with the cell, the hemagglutinin brushes against molecules of sialic acid that jut out from the surface of cells in the respiratory tract. Hemagglutinin and sialic acid have shapes that fit snugly together, and the hemagglutinin binds to the sialic acid receptor like a hand going into a glove. As the virus sits against the cell membrane, more spikes of hemagglutinin bind to more sialic acid receptors. They work like grappling hooks thrown by pirates onto a vessel, lashing it fast. Once this binding holds the virus and cell fast, the virus has achieved its first task, adsorption, adherence to the body of the target cell. This step marks the beginning of the end for the cell, and the beginning of a successful invasion by the virus. Soon a pit forms in the cell membrane beneath the virus, and the virus slips through the pit to enter entirely within the cell in a kind of bubble called a vesicle. If, for some reason, the influenza virus cannot penetrate the cell membrane, it can detach itself and then bind to another cell that it can penetrate. Few other viruses can do this. By entering the cell, as opposed to fusing with the cell on the cell membrane, which many other viruses do, the influenza virus hides from the immune system. The body's defenses cannot find it and kill it. Inside this vesicle, this bubble, shape and form shift and create new possibilities as the hemagglutinin faces a more acidic environment. This acidity makes it cleave in two and refold itself into an entirely different shape. The refolding process somewhat resembles taking a sock off a foot, turning it inside out and sticking a fist in it. The cell is now doomed. The newly exposed part of the hemagglutinin interacts with the vesicle, and the membrane of the virus begins to dissolve. Virologists call this the uncoating of the virus and fusion with the cell. Soon the genes of the virus spill into the cell, then penetrate to the cell nucleus, insert themselves into the cell's genome, displace some of the cell's own genes, and begin issuing orders. The cell begins to produce viral proteins instead of its own. Within a few hours, these proteins are packaged with new copies of the viral genes. Meanwhile, the spikes of neuraminidase, the other protuberance that jutted out from the surface of the virus, are performing another function. Electron micrographs show neuraminidase to have a box-like head extending from a thin stalk, and attached to the head are what look like four identical six-bladed propellers. The neuraminidase breaks up the sialic acid remaining on the cell surface. This destroys the acid's ability to bind to influenza viruses. This is crucial. Otherwise, when new viruses burst from the cell, they could be caught as if on flypaper. They might bind to and be trapped by sialic acid receptors on the dead cell's disintegrating membrane. The neuraminidase guarantees that new viruses can escape to invade other cells. Again, few other viruses do anything similar. From the time an influenza virus first attaches to a cell to the time the cell bursts generally takes about 10 hours, although it can take less time or, more rarely, longer. Then a swarm of between 100,000 and 1 million new influenza viruses escapes the exploded cell. The word swarm fits in more ways than one. Whenever an organism reproduces, its genes try to make exact copies of themselves. But sometimes mistakes, mutations, occur in this process. This is true whether the genes belong to people, plants, or viruses. The more advanced the organism, however, the more mechanisms exist to prevent mutations. A person mutates at a much slower rate than bacteria. Bacteria mutate at a much slower rate than a virus. And a DNA virus mutates at a much slower rate than an RNA virus. DNA has a kind of built-in proofreading mechanism to cut down on copying mistakes. RNA has no proofreading mechanism whatsoever, no way to protect against mutation. So viruses that use RNA to carry their genetic information mutate much faster, from 10,000 to 1 million times faster than any DNA virus. Different RNA viruses mutate at different rates as well. A few mutate so rapidly that virologists consider them not so much a population of copies of the same virus as what they call a quasi-species or a mutant swarm. These mutant swarms contain trillions and trillions of closely related but different viruses. Even the viruses produced from a single cell will include many different versions of themselves, and the swarm as a whole will routinely contain almost every possible permutation of its genetic code. Most of these mutations interfere with the functioning of the virus and will either destroy the virus outright or destroy its ability to infect. But other mutations, sometimes in a single base, a single letter in its genetic code, will allow the virus to adapt rapidly to a new situation. It is this adaptability that explains why these quasi-species, these mutant swarms, can move rapidly back and forth between different environments and also develop extraordinarily rapid drug resistance. As one investigator has observed, the rapid mutation confers a certain randomness to the disease processes that accompany RNA viral infections. Influenza is an RNA virus. So is HIV and the coronavirus. And of all RNA viruses, influenza and HIV are among those that mutate the fastest. The influenza virus mutates so fast that 99% of the 100,000 to 1 million new viruses that burst out of a cell in the reproduction process are too defective to infect another cell and reproduce again. But that still leaves between 1,000 and 10,000 viruses that can infect another cell. Both influenza and HIV fit the concept of a quasi-species, of a mutant swarm. In both, a drug-resistant mutation can emerge within days, and the influenza virus reproduces rapidly, far faster than HIV. Therefore, it adapts rapidly as well, often too rapidly for the immune system to respond. Chapter 8. An infection is an act of violence. It is an invasion, a rape, and the body reacts violently. John Hunter, the great physiologist of the 18th century, defined life as the ability to resist putrefaction, resist infection. Even if one disagrees with that definition, resisting putrefaction certainly does define the ability to live. The body's defender is its immune system, an extraordinarily complex, intricate, and interwoven combination of various kinds of white blood cells, antibodies, enzymes, toxins, and other proteins. The key to the immune system is its ability to distinguish what belongs in the body, self, from what does not belong, non-self. This ability depends, again, upon reading the language of shape and form. The components of the immune system, white blood cells, enzymes, antibodies, and other elements, circulate throughout the body, penetrating everywhere. When they collide with other cells or proteins or organisms, they interact with and read physical markings and structures just as the influenza virus does when it searches for, finds, and latches on to a cell. Anything carrying a self marking, the immune system leaves alone. It does, that is, when the system works properly. Autoimmune diseases such as lupus or multiple sclerosis develop when the immune system attacks its own body. But if the immune system feels a non-self marking, either foreign invaders or the body's own cells that have become diseased, it responds. In fact, it attacks. The physical markings that the immune system feels and reads and then binds to are called antigens. The word refers to, very simply, anything that stimulates the immune system to respond. Some elements of the immune system, such as so-called natural killer cells, will attack anything that bears any non-self marking, any foreign antigen. This is referred to as innate or non-specific immunity, and it serves as a first line of defense that counterattacks within hours of infection. But the bulk of the immune system is far more targeted, far more focused, far more specific. Antibodies, for example, carry thousands of receptors on their surface to recognize and bind to a target antigen. Each one of those thousands of receptors is identical. So antibodies bearing these receptors will recognize and bind only to, for example, a virus bearing that antigen. They will not bind to any other invading organism. One link between the non-specific and specific immune response is a particular and rare kind of white blood cell called a dendritic cell. Dendritic cells attack bacteria and viruses indiscriminately, engulf them, then process their antigens and present those antigens. In effect, they chop up an invading microorganism into pieces and display the antigens like a trophy flag. The dendritic cells then travel to the spleen or the lymph nodes, where large numbers of other white blood cells concentrate. There, these other white blood cells learn to recognize the antigen as a foreign invader and begin the process of producing huge numbers of antibodies and killer white cells that will attack the target antigen and anything attached to the antigen. The recognition of a foreign antigen also sets off a parallel chain of events as the body releases enzymes. Some of these affect the entire body, for example, raising its temperature and causing fever. Others directly attack and kill the target. Still others serve as chemical messengers, summoning white blood cells to areas of invasion or dilating capillaries so killer cells can exit the bloodstream at the point of attack. Swelling, redness, and fever are all side effects of the release of these chemicals. All this together is called the immune response, and once the immune system is mobilized, it is formidable indeed. But all this takes time. The delay can allow infections to gain a foothold in the body, even to advance in raging cadres that can kill. In the days before antibiotics, an infection launched a race to the death between the pathogen and the immune system. Sometimes a victim would become desperately ill. Then, suddenly and almost miraculously, the fever would break and the victim would recover. This resolution by crisis occurred when the immune system barely won the race, when it counterattacked massively and successfully. But once the body survives an infection, it gains an advantage. For the immune system epitomizes the saying that that which does not kill you makes you stronger. After it defeats an infection, specialized white cells, called memory T cells, and antibodies that bind to the antigen remain in the body. If any invader carrying the same antigen attacks again, the immune system responds far more quickly than the first time. When the immune system can respond so quickly that a new infection will not even cause symptoms, people become immune to the disease. Vaccinations expose people to an antigen and mobilize the immune system to respond to that disease. In modern medicine, some vaccines contain only the antigen, some contain whole killed pathogens, and some contain living but weakened ones. They all alert the immune system and allow the body to mount an immediate response if anything bearing that antigen invades the body. The same process occurs in the body naturally with the influenza virus. After people recover from the disease, their immune systems will very quickly target the antigens on the virus that infected them. But influenza has a way to evade the immune system. The chief antigens of the influenza virus are the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase protruding from its surface. But of all the parts of the influenza virus that mutate, the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase mutate the fastest. This makes it impossible for the immune system to keep pace. By no means do the antigens of all viruses, even all RNA viruses, mutate rapidly. Measles is an RNA virus and mutates at roughly the same rate as influenza. Yet measles antigens do not change. Other parts of the virus do, but the antigens remain constant. The most likely reason is that the part of the measles virus that the immune system recognizes as an antigen plays an integral role in the function of the virus itself. If it changes shape, the virus cannot survive. So a single exposure to measles usually gives lifetime immunity. Hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, however, can shift into different forms and still function. The result? Their mutations allow them to evade the immune system, but do not destroy the virus. In fact, they mutate so rapidly that even during a single epidemic, both the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase often change. Sometimes the mutations cause changes so minor that the immune system can still recognize them, bind to them, and easily overcome a second infection from the same virus. But sometimes mutations change the shape of the hemagglutinin or neuraminidase enough that the immune system can't read them. The antibodies that bound perfectly to the old shapes do not fit well to the new one. This phenomenon happens so often it has a name. Antigen drift. When antigen drift occurs, the virus can gain a foothold even in people whose immune system has loaded itself with antibodies that bind to the older shapes. Obviously, the greater the change, the less efficiently the immune system can respond. One way to conceptualize antigen drift is to think of a football player wearing a uniform with white pants, a green shirt, and a white helmet with a green V emblazoned on it. The immune system can recognize this uniform instantly and attack it. If the uniform changes slightly, if, for example, a green stripe is added to the white pants while everything else remains the same, the immune system will continue to recognize the virus with little difficulty. But if the uniform goes from green shirt and white pants to white shirt with green pants, the immune system may not recognize the virus so easily. Antigen drift can create epidemics. One study found 19 discrete, identifiable epidemics in the United States in a 33-year period, more than one every other year. Each one caused between 10,000 and 40,000 excess deaths in the United States alone, an excess over and above the death toll usually caused by the disease. As a result, influenza kills more people in the United States than any other infectious disease, including AIDS. Public health experts monitor this drift and each year adjust the flu vaccine to try to keep pace. But they will never be able to match up perfectly, because even if they predict the direction of mutation, the fact that influenza viruses exist as mutating swarms means some will always be different enough to evade both the vaccine and the immune system. But as serious as antigen drift can be, as lethal an influenza as that phenomenon can create, it does not cause great pandemics. It does not create firestorms of influenza that spread worldwide, such as those in 1889 to 90, in 1918 to 19, in 1957, and in 1968. Pandemics generally develop only when a radical change in the hemagglutinin, or the neuraminidase, or both, occurs. When an entirely new gene coding for one or both replaces the old one, the shape of the new antigen bears little resemblance to the old one. This is called antigen shift. To use the football uniform analogy again, antigen shift is the equivalent of the virus changing from a green shirt and white pants to an orange shirt and black pants. When antigen shift occurs, the immune system cannot recognize the antigen at all. Few people in the world will have antibodies that can protect them against this new virus, so the virus can spread through a population at an explosive rate. Hemagglutinin occurs in 15 known basic shapes, neuraminidase in 9, and they occur in different combinations with subtypes. Virologists use these antigens to identify what particular virus they are discussing or investigating. H1N1, for example, is the name given the 1918 virus, currently found in swine. An H3N2 virus is circulating among people today. Antigen shift occurs when a virus that normally infects birds attacks humans directly or indirectly. In Hong Kong in 1997, an influenza virus identified as H5N1 spread directly from chickens to people, infecting 18 and killing 6. Birds and humans have different sialic acid receptors, so a virus that binds to a bird's sialic acid receptor will not normally bind to, and thus infect, a human cell. In Hong Kong, what most likely happened was that the 18 people who got sick were subjected to massive exposure to the virus. The swarm of these viruses, the quasi-species, likely contained a mutation that could bind to human receptors, and the massive exposure allowed that mutation to gain a foothold in the victims. Yet the virus did not adapt itself to humans. All those who got sick were infected directly from chickens. But the virus can adapt to man. It can do so directly, with an entire animal virus jumping to humans and adapting with a simple mutation. It can also happen indirectly. For one final and unusual attribute of the influenza virus makes it particularly adept at moving from species to species. The influenza virus not only mutates rapidly, but it also has a segmented genome. This means that its genes do not lie along a continuous strand of its nucleic acid, as do genes in most organisms, including most other viruses. Instead, influenza genes are carried in unconnected strands of RNA. Therefore, if two different influenza viruses infect the same cell, reassortment of their genes becomes very possible. Reassortment mixes some of the segments of the genes of one virus with some from the other. It is like shuffling two different decks of cards together, then making up a new deck with cards from each one. This creates an entirely new hybrid virus, which increases the chances of a virus jumping from one species to another. If the Hong Kong chicken influenza had infected someone who was simultaneously infected with a human influenza virus, the two viruses might easily have reassorted their genes. They might have formed a new virus that could pass easily from person to person, and the lethal virus might have adapted to humans. The virus may also adapt indirectly, through an intermediary. Some virologists theorize that pigs provide a perfect mixing bowl because the sialic acid receptors on their cells can bind to both bird and human viruses. Whenever an avian virus infects swine at the same time that a human virus does, reassortment of the two viruses can occur. and an entirely new virus can emerge that can infect man. In 1918, veterinarians noted outbreaks of influenza in pigs and other mammals, and pigs today still get influenza from a direct descendant of the 1918 virus. But it is not clear whether pigs caught the disease from man or man caught it from pigs. And Dr. Peter Polisi at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, one of the world's leading experts on influenza viruses, considers the mixing bowl theory unnecessary to explain antigen shift. It's equally likely that co-infection of avian and human virus in a human in one cell in the lung gives rise to the virus. There's no reason why mixing couldn't occur in the lung, whether in pig or man. It's not absolute that there are no sialic acid receptors of those types in other species. It's not absolute that the avian receptor is really that different from the human, and with one single amino acid change, the virus can go much better in another host. In 2001, Australian scientist Mark Gibbs advanced a theory that the influenza virus can also recombine its genes. Recombination means taking part of one gene and combining it with part of another gene. It is like cutting all the cards of two decks in pieces, taping the pieces together randomly, then assembling the first 52 for a new deck. Recombination has been demonstrated, but most virologists are skeptical of Gibbs's hypothesis. Antigen shift. This radical departure from existing antigens led to major pandemics long before modern transportation allowed rapid movement of people. There is mixed opinion as to whether several pandemics in the 15th and 16th centuries were influenza, although most medical historians believe that they were, largely because of the speed of their movement and the number of people who fell ill. In 1510, a pandemic of pulmonary disease came from Africa and attacked at once and raged all over Europe, not missing a family and scarce a person. In 1580, another pandemic started in Asia, then spread to Africa, Europe, and America. It was so fierce that in the space of 6 weeks, it afflicted almost all the nations of Europe, of whom hardly the 20th person was free of the disease, and some Spanish cities were nearly entirely depopulated by the disease. There is no dispute, though, that other pandemics in the past were influenza. In 1688, the year of the Glorious Revolution, influenza struck England, Ireland, and Virginia. In these places, the people died, as in a plague. 5 years later, influenza spread again across Europe. All conditions of persons were attacked. Those who were very strong and hardy were taken in the same manner as the weak and spoiled, the youngest as well as the oldest. In January 1699 in Massachusetts, Cotton Mather wrote, "The sickness extended to almost all families. Few or none escaped, and many died, especially in Boston, and some died in a strange or unusual manner. In some families all were sick together. In some towns almost all were sick so that it was a time of disease." At least three and possibly six pandemics struck Europe in the 18th century, and at least four struck in the 19th century. In 1847 and 1848 in London, more people died from influenza than died of cholera during the great cholera epidemic of 1832. And in 1889 and 1890, a great and violent worldwide pandemic, although nothing that even approached 1918 in violence, struck again. In the 20th century, three pandemics struck. Each was caused by an antigen shift, by radical changes in either the hemagglutinin or the neuraminidase antigens, or both, or by changes in some other gene or genes. Influenza pandemics generally infect from 15% to 40% of a population. Any influenza virus infecting that many people and killing a significant percentage would be beyond a nightmare. In recent years, public health authorities have at least twice identified a new virus infecting humans, but successfully prevented it from adapting to man. To prevent the 1997 Hong Kong virus, which killed 6 of 18 people infected, from adapting to people, public health authorities had every single chicken then in Hong Kong, 1.2 million of them, slaughtered. The action did not wipe out this H5N1 virus. It survives in chickens, and in 2003, it infected two more people, killing one. A vaccine for this particular virus has been developed, although it has not been stockpiled. An even greater slaughter of animals occurred in the spring of 2003 when a new H7N7 virus appeared in poultry farms in the Netherlands, Belgium, and Germany. This virus infected 82 people and killed one, and it also infected pigs. So public health authorities killed nearly 30 million poultry and some swine. This costly and dreadful slaughter was done to prevent what happened in 1918. It was done to stop either of these influenza viruses from adapting to and killing man. One more thing makes influenza unusual. When a new influenza virus emerges, it is highly competitive, even cannibalistic. It usually drives older types into extinction. This happens because infection stimulates the body's immune system to generate all its defenses against all influenza viruses to which the body has ever been exposed. When older viruses attempt to infect someone, they cannot gain a foothold. They cease replicating. They die out. So, unlike practically every other known virus, only one type, one swarm or quasi-species of influenza virus dominates at any given time. This itself helps prepare the way for a new pandemic, since the more time passes, the fewer people's immune systems will recognize other antigens. Not all pandemics are lethal. Antigen shift guarantees that the new virus will infect huge numbers of people, but it does not guarantee that it will kill large numbers. The 20th century saw three pandemics. The most recent new virus attacked in 1968 when the H3N2 Hong Kong flu spread worldwide with high morbidity but very low mortality. That is, it made many sick but killed few. The Asian flu, an H2N2 virus, came in 1957. While nothing like 1918, this was still a violent pandemic. Then, of course, there was the H1N1 virus of 1918, the virus that created its own killing fields. Part 3. The Tinderbox. Chapter 9. In the spring of 1918, death was no stranger to the world. Indeed, by then the bodies of more than 5 million soldiers had already been fed into what was called the sausage factory by generals whose stupidity was matched only by their brutality. German generals, for example, had decided to bleed France into submission by matching it death for death at Verdun, believing that Germany's greater population would leave it victorious. The French later replied with their own massive offensive, believing that their élan vital would triumph. Only slaughter triumphed. Finally, one French regiment refused orders to make a suicidal charge. The mutiny spread to 54 divisions, stopped only by mass arrests, the conviction of 23,000 men for mutiny, with 400 sentenced to death and 55 actually executed. Yet nothing expressed the brutality of this war, as did a sanitation report on the planned eradication of rats in the trenches to prevent the spread of disease. A major noted, "Certain unexpected problems are involved in the rat problem. The rat serves one useful function. He consumes the corpses on no man's land, a job which the rat alone is willing to undertake. For this reason, it has been found desirable to control rather than eliminate the rat population." All of Europe was weary of the war. Only in the United States, Anglophiles and Francophiles, most of them concentrated on the East Coast and many of them holding positions of power or influence, were not weary. Only in the United States, Anglophiles and Francophiles still regarded war as glorious. And they put intense pressure on President Woodrow Wilson to enter the war. The war had begun in 1914. Wilson had withstood this pressure. A German submarine had sunk the Lusitania in 1915, and he had not gone to war despite outrage in the press, instead winning a German commitment to limit submarine warfare. He had resisted other justifications for war. He could fairly campaign for re-election in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And he warned, "If you elect my opponent, you elect a war." On election night, he went to bed believing he had lost, but woke up re-elected by one of the narrowest margins in history. Then Germany took a great gamble. On January 31st, 1917, giving only 24 hours' notice, it announced unrestricted submarine warfare against neutral and merchant vessels. It believed that it could starve Britain and France into submission before the United States, if the United States did at last declare war, could help. The action utterly outraged the nation. Still, Wilson did not go to war. Then came the Zimmermann note. Captured documents revealed that the German foreign minister had proposed to Mexico that it join Germany in war against the United States and reconquer parts of New Mexico, Texas, and Arizona. Wilson's critics sputtered in fury at his pusillanimity. In a famous essay, pacifist and socialist Randolph Bourne, who later died in the influenza epidemic, lamented, "The war sentiment, begun so gradually but so perseveringly by the preparedness advocates who come from the ranks of big business, caught hold of one after another of the intellectual groups. With the aid of Theodore Roosevelt, the murmurs became a monotonous chant, and finally a chorus so mighty that to be out of it was at first to be disreputable and finally almost obscene. And slowly a strident rant was worked up against Germany." On April 2nd, 3 weeks after the disclosure of the note, after his cabinet unanimously called for war, Wilson finally delivered his war message to Congress. 2 days later, he explained to a friend, "It was necessary for me by very slow stages and with the most genuine purpose to avoid war, to lead the country on to a single way of thinking." And so the United States entered the war filled with a sense of selfless mission, believing glory still possible, and still keeping itself separate from what it regarded as the corrupt old world. It fought alongside Britain, France, Italy, and Russia, not as an ally, but as an associated power. Anyone who believed that Wilson's reluctant embrace of war meant that he would not prosecute it aggressively knew nothing of him. He was one of those rare men who believed almost to the point of mental illness in his own righteousness. Wilson believed, in fact, that his will and spirit were informed by the spirit and hope of a people and even of God. He talked of his sympathetic connection, which I am sure that I have with all American citizens, and said, "I am sure that my heart speaks the same thing that they wish their hearts to speak. I will not cry peace so long as there is sin and wrong in the world," he went on. America was born to exemplify that devotion to the elements of righteousness which are derived from the revelations of Holy Scripture. He is probably the only American president to have held to this belief with quite such conviction, with no sign of self-doubt. It is a trait more associated with crusaders than politicians. To Wilson, this war was a crusade, and he intended to wage total war. Perhaps knowing himself even more than the country, he predicted, "Once lead this people into war, and they'll forget there ever was such a thing as tolerance. To fight, you must be brutal and ruthless, and the spirit of ruthless brutality will enter into the very fiber of our national life, infecting Congress, the courts, the policeman on the beat, the man in the street." America had never been and would never be so informed by the will of its chief executive. Not during the Civil War with the suspension of habeas corpus. Not during Korea and the McCarthy period. Not even during World War II. He would turn the nation into a weapon, an explosive device. As an unintended consequence, the nation became a tinderbox for epidemic disease as well. Wilson declared, "It isn't an army we must shape and train for war, it is a nation." To train the nation, Wilson used an iron fist minus any velvet glove. He did have some legitimate reasons for concern, reasons to justify a hard line. For reasons entirely unrelated to the war, America was a rumbling chaos of change and movement, its very nature and identity shifting. In 1870, the United States numbered only 40 million souls, 72% of whom lived in small towns or on farms. By the time America entered the war, the population had increased to roughly 105 million. Between 1900 and 1915 alone, 15 million immigrants flooded the United States. Most came from Eastern and Southern Europe, with new languages and religions, along with darker complexions. And the first census after the war would also be the first one to find more people living in urban areas than rural. The single largest ethnic group in the United States was German-American, and a large German-language press had been sympathetic to Germany. Would German-Americans fight against Germany? The Irish Republican Army had launched an uprising against British rule on Easter 1916. Would Irish-Americans fight to help Britain? The Midwest was isolationist. Would it send soldiers across an ocean when the United States had not been attacked? Populists opposed war, and Wilson's own Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, three times the Democratic nominee for president, had resigned from the cabinet in 1915 after Wilson responded too aggressively for him to Germany's torpedoing the Lusitania. Socialists and radical unionists were strong in factories, in mining communities in the Rockies, in the Northwest. Would they, drafted or not, defend capitalism? The hard line was designed to intimidate those reluctant to support the war into doing so, and to crush or eliminate those who would not. Even before entering the war, Wilson had warned Congress, "There are citizens of the United States, I blush to admit, who have poured the poison of disloyalty into the very arteries of our national life. Such creatures of passion, disloyalty, and anarchy must be crushed out." He intended to do so. His fire informed virtually everything that happened in the country, including fashion. To save cloth, a war material, everything was a war material. Designers narrowed lapels and eliminated or shrank pockets. And his fury particularly informed every act of the United States government. During the Civil War, Lincoln had suspended the writ of habeas corpus, imprisoning hundreds of people. But those imprisoned presented a real threat of armed rebellion. He left unchecked, extraordinarily harsh criticism. Wilson believed he had not gone far enough and told his cousin, "Thank God for Abraham Lincoln. I won't make the mistakes that he made." The government compelled conformity, controlled speech in ways, frightening ways, not known in America before or since. Soon after the declaration of war, Wilson pushed the Espionage Act through a cooperative Congress, which balked only at legalizing outright press censorship, despite Wilson's calling it an imperative necessity. The bill gave Postmaster General Albert Sidney Burleson the right to refuse to deliver any periodical he deemed unpatriotic or critical of the administration. And before television and radio, most of the political discourse in the country went through the mails. A Southerner, a narrow man and a hater, nominally a populist but closer to the pitchfork Ben Tillman wing of the party than to that of William Jennings Bryan, Burleson soon had the post office stop delivery of virtually all publications and any foreign language publication that hinted at less than enthusiastic support of the war. Attorney General Thomas Gregory called for still more power. Gregory was a progressive, largely responsible for Wilson's nominating Louis Brandeis to the Supreme Court, a liberal and the court's first Jew. Now, observing that America was a country governed by public opinion, Gregory intended to help Wilson rule opinion and, through opinion, the country. He demanded that the Librarian of Congress report the names of those who had asked for certain books and also explained that the government needed to monitor the individual casual or impulsive disloyal utterances. to do the latter, Gregory pushed for a law broad enough to punish statements made from good motives or if traitorous motives weren't provable. The administration got such a law. In 1798, Federalist President John Adams and his party, under pressure of undeclared war with France, passed the Sedition Act, which made it unlawful to print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, or malicious writing against the government. But that law inflamed controversy, contributed to Adams's re-election defeat, and led to the only impeachment of a Supreme Court justice in history, when Samuel Chase both helped get grand jury indictments of critics and then sentenced these same critics to maximum terms. Wilson's administration went further, yet engendered little opposition. The new Sedition Act made it punishable by 20 years in jail to utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the government of the United States. One could go to jail for cursing the government or criticizing it, even if what one said was true. Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the Supreme Court opinion that found the act constitutional. After the war ended, upholding lengthy prison terms for the defendants, arguing that the First Amendment did not protect speech if the words used create a clear and present danger. To enforce that law, the head of what became the Federal Bureau of Investigation agreed to make a volunteer group called the American Protective League an adjunct to the Justice Department, and authorized them to carry badges identifying them as Secret Service. Within a few months, the APL would have 90,000.